Good afternoon. While we have another number of cases that are being submitted this afternoon, we only have one oral argument, and you're it. So your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Mark Pittman, to my left, Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Lee Gabriel. So if the clerk will call the case, we will proceed.
The court will now call John Kochek versus Ontario Resources Corporation. May it please the court. Mr. Deckard Comack will argue for the appellant. Mr. Will Thompson will argue for the appellate. Okay.
Mr. Comack.
Thank you. May it please the court. This case includes one claim that Antero has, one substantive claim that Antero has brought against Mr. Kochek, and that is a breach of fiduciary duty claim. There are four counts in the first amended petition, but the initial claim is breach of fiduciary duty. They've submitted recently additional authority to the court in an attempt to show that the conduct that they have accused Mr. Kochek of committing is not subject to the TCPA. That is not, in fact, the case. A communication can be inherent in a cause of action, as shown in Abeta Cola versus Two Savages Concrete Pumping. The court dealt with the denial of a TCPA motion by the trial court where the plaintiff did not specifically allege communications. Apparently, Antero believes that Mr. Kochek somehow in a vacuum is able to commit a bribery scheme or a kickback scheme without communications with the person that he is allegedly bribing or being bribed by or receiving kickbacks from. The term scheme appears in the first amended petition 11 times. That's not only do they use the word scheme in the petition, then they go into their appellate brief and use it again 11 times.
But, sir, the most recent opinion out of this case is Judge Gabriel's opinion in Crestview.
Yes,
do you think Crestview doesn't apply to this case, or is it wrong?
I don't believe that Crestview is necessarily wrong, Your Honor, but I believe that it's distinguishable from the facts of this case, specifically because in Crestview, the court said that the pleadings did not specifically allege communications. It was the actions of Dr. Smith that formed the basis of the allegations against him. In this case, Antero is alleging the bribery scheme is the basis of the communications. And we submit to the court that you cannot have a scheme without communications. You can't have a scheme, a bribery scheme, or a kickback scheme with yourself. In fact, in the press release that Antero submitted, or that Antero's attorneys put on their website, immediately upon filing the original petition, and this is at clerk's record page 353, it says lawsuit, former employee operated kickback scheme. It's not former employee breached fiduciary duty. It's always about the scheme. And so they can't divorce or divest, they can't say that the conduct of the kickback scheme or the bribery scheme is inferred without also inferring that there were communications involved between Mr. Kochek and his alleged co-conspirator or co-schemist. And having established
that have to infer there was a communication.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because they use the term scheme over and over and over. And in addition to that, they actually do allege that he disclosed information. That is a communication. Part of the breach of fiduciary duty claim is that he disclosed confidential information to Mr. Robertson or his companies. So that is an explicit disclosure of or allegation of communicating to Mr. Robertson.
So in every breach, or not in every breach of fiduciary, but in a breach of fiduciary claim based upon a disclosure of confidential information, you're saying every one of those would be protected by the TCPA because it's a disclosure, it's a communication?
I believe it could be, Your Honor. In a scenario, I mean, everything should be taken on a case-by-case basis. In this particular case, they're alleging that the basis of their allegations is that he disclosed the information to Mr. Robertson as part of the kickback scheme. There had to be the communication, and we're claiming that that's a protected communication because of his right of association and the fact that he's a friend. So it falls within the purview of TCPA because of what the TCPA is designed to
Let's talk about the right to association here. The only basis for your TCPA or the application of the TCPA is the right to association, correct? We're not relying on speech or?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the exercise of the right of association means communication between individuals who join together to collectively express, promote, pursue, or defend common interests. That's the definition in the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, basically, if I understand the statements in your brief, you're saying a common interest equals an interest shared by two individuals, even if they're doing something illegal or tortuous.
I believe that is a common interest, whether or not it is, whether or not it's illegal or legal, then falls on the person or the party that has to prove their clear and specific prima facie case.
So if we have, and I'm not saying your client's stealing from anybody, but this is just my example. We have an individual who steals from somebody, no TCPA implication, because we don't have two people exercising a common interest.
I would agree with that, Your
Honor. Okay, we have two individuals who allegedly stole from another party. TCPA applies.
Depends on the facts of the case, Your Honor.
Okay. Yeah, let's assume that they're stealing, and you believe it indicates that there's a common interest between these two people. Just like in this case, we're saying that two people got together and allegedly, tortuously took money from a third party. You say the TCPA applies. Don't you have to say that in this case?
Well, Your Honor, in your example, two individuals got together and they went and
let's say they communicated everything with the predicate acts, that you're saying they shared a common interest. If they engaged in an illegal or tortuous act, the TCPA applies if they're two individuals.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So then if we have two business entities, they engage in exactly the same conduct, then the TCPA doesn't apply.
Well, now you're getting into a commercial speech exception, Your Honor, and that's...
No, I'm not getting into a commercial speech exception. The statute talks about two individuals. I'm just trying to... I think that we're through the looking glass when we say that the TCPA applies to situations like this. So I'm trying to figure out what the parameters are initially.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that your analogy applies here simply because the allegations are against two individuals. It's not two businesses. It's Mr. Kowchek and Mr. Robertson.
But if it were two business entities, two corporations, then the TCPA wouldn't apply.
On its face, I'd agree with that statement,
okay.
Your Honor.
So tell me what cases have defined the word common with respect to the term common interest.
I don't know those off the top of my head, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, certainly you have help from the Austin court with respect to the Grant case, the Autocraft case, and the Elite case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, what about the Dallas's court's opinion in Exxon that to interpret it, that a common interest basically to steal money from somebody else in this context is an absurd construction of the statute?
Well, I mean, taking it in a vacuum, I agree that the statute should not be designed to protect criminal activity. In this,
what about tortious activity?
Well, I believe that once you establish that there's a, we're still in the communication realm, Your Honor. We're talking about the communication.
No, we're not. You're going at the front end of the statute. I'm coming in at the back end of the definition. What is a common interest? How should we define the term common interest?
Well, I think you just look at the language of the statute, Your Honor, of what a common if two individuals have a common interest, I mean, now we're trying to define the word common. It's an interest
right.
Shared by two individuals.
Okay, and that's the plain meaning of the statute?
I believe it is.
Okay, what if the word first definition in Webster's was of or relating to a community at large of the word common?
I don't have Webster's in front of me, Your Honor. If that's what it says, I'm not going to debate you on it.
Okay. Well, that's, I'm not, I'm really truly not trying to trick you. That's what it actually says, is if, do we, should we define the word common in the statute to have some meaning above and beyond simply beyond two individuals getting together in a business?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's, I mean, that's up to the legislature, but the plain meaning of the word common, there's two individuals, if they share something, then they share it in common. I have things in common with my spouse that I don't have in common with anyone else.
Then basically the statute applies to any relationship between two people. It's a common interest. If they have a business relationship, if they have a tortious, some type of tortious relationship as alleged in this case, then a lawsuit that's predicated on that kind of relationship automatically implicates the TCPA.
Well, I would say in every case of tort, there's going to be some type of wrong that's alleged. And if there's two people, there's a common interest between those two people, then you have to look at what evidence supports that allegation.
So if there's a tort between two people and they're exercising some type of, they're promoting some type of shared interest, then automatically the TCPA applies to that case and the burden shifts to the other side to come forward with clear and specific evidence of each element, establishing a prima facie case of each element of their cause of action.
Well, again, I think, Your Honor, that goes back to Justice Gabriel's opinion in Crestview, where it's what's pled is whether or not that what is pled can also inform whether the TCPA applies. In that case, this court held that the specific allegations were not about the communications, but the allegations of wrongdoing dealt with the actions that the individual took. In this case, the pleadings are predicated on the scheme between the two people.
And I understand what you're telling me, but we're talking about communications there. We're not talking about how this court defines what the word common means is used in this statute. You can have a communication all you want to, but that doesn't mean it necessarily covers a common interest if you define common less broadly than simply an interest shared between two individuals.
But if you don't, Your Honor, I would submit that you're going down a slippery slope of where what's the limit? Is it five people? Is it 10 people? Is it 1,000 people? Is it a 4A school? Is it a 6A school?
I agree with you, but we don't have to make that determination here. All we would have to say is that common is something that exceeds simply a relationship between two people to commit a tortious act.
That's your purview, Your Honor. I would disagree with that based on the reading of the statute and the common usage of the word common.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So moving into the actual conduct that's been complained of, the Antero admits that they don't have any direct evidence. They have only inference as it relates to the conduct of Mr. Kowchak. They don't have anything to show that there was a scheme in place. They allege a scheme, and they show that there was, they plead that there was money received from Mr. Robertson by Mr. Kowchak, but they have nothing, and on page 23 of their brief, they even say, inference is all that's required. But the Supreme Court has said that when there's competing inferences and they're equal, then there's no inference at all. Mr. Kowchak has ample direct evidence, testimonial evidence, that he and Robertson were friends, that they were, their common interest was, had nothing to do with Antero. In fact, so that puts it in Kowchak's mind, or in Kowchak's position, on equal footing. In the case of Mr. Kowchak, though, it goes far beyond that. He had invested over $400,000 of his own money in Antero. So their allegation is that he somehow undertook these actions to harm Antero, which harmed his investment by the time that they say he committed these acts was in the millions of dollars. It's irrational to think that he would undertake this activity to harm himself to the and harm his investment in that company. Again, when you look at the uncontroverted evidence, Antero repeatedly said, with Mr. Kalchick as the superintendent, Antero was the most efficient, most cost-effective, had the lowest cost and highest production of any operation in the Utica Shale in West Virginia. Mr. Kalchick was the superintendent. He was the head guy for Antero on the ground during the time that they alleged that he committed all of these tortious acts. I submit to the court that the inference of Mr. Kalchick, the direct evidence of Mr. Kalchick, that he would not do anything to harm his investment, far outweighs the inference that he was, that the conduct between him and Mr. Robertson constituted a bribery or kickback scheme that is manufactured wholly by Antero.
Aren't you asking us to weigh inferences, and isn't that a duty for a jury rather for an appellate than for an appellate court?
Well,
except, give him three more minutes, please, ma'am.
Yes.
Thank you.
Except in the context of when you're weighing clear and specific evidence in the context of a TCPA action. Pardon me, just a moment. The equal inference rule under Hancock says that the evidence shows that Antero's evidence is no evidence when you have competing equal inferences, and we're submitting that that it has to be that the inferences have to be clear and without doubt. Not without doubt.
But actually, all Lipsky says is it's the minimum quantum of evidence necessary to support a rational inference that the allegation is true. They don't establish a standard of unambiguous, sure, or free from doubt, do they, in Lipsky? The Supreme Court does.
It does not, Your Honor, but what we're saying is that Antero's, when you weigh Antero's inference against Kalchick's direct testimony, it is no inference. There is no inference there that's sufficient to meet the clear and specific burden.
So we're supposed to weigh evidence in deciding an appeal on a motion to dismiss under the TCPA. Is that your argument?
Well, the court reviews it de novo, Your Honor, and I believe that if there are two competing inferences, and you have to consider both the...
But you said it's not an inference. It's direct evidence on your part. It's just an inference on their part.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And we're supposed to weigh that and make a fact decision that governs this appeal.
In this case, Your Honor, under the TCPA, I believe that it's within the court's purview to say that they didn't meet their burden of clear and specific evidence when they're relying on an inference in the face of direct evidence.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
You give the opposing counsel the extra 3 minutes as well. Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Will Thompson for the plaintiff appellee Antero Resources. The trial court's decision should be affirmed for three independent reasons. First, the TCPA does not apply at the threshold. Second, Antero's established a prima facie case for its claims. And third, Mr. Kalchick waived his right to seek dismissal under the statute by first serving discovery before filing a motion to dismiss and seeking relief under the TCPA. Turning to the TCPA, the statute is clear that it's only triggered by communications. And in this case, Antero is suing the defendant for his conduct. That is, the quid pro quo kickback scheme that he engaged in, not any communications that he made. And throughout this litigation, both at the trial court and on appeal, the defendant has failed to identify a single specific communication that forms the factual basis for Antero's claims. And that's because none exists. Instead, the crux of his argument is that somewhere along the way when he was perpetrating the kickback scheme, he had to have spoken to his co-conspirator. That's his argument. But this court rejected that exact argument less than 2 months ago in Justice Gabriel's opinion, Smith versus Crestview. So Crestview involved a scheme to peddle a phony medical product. And the court looked at, in looking at that case, the court examined whether the factual basis for the liability was conduct or communications. If it's conduct, the TCPA doesn't apply. And what I think is particularly notable about Smith versus Crestview is in that case there was record evidence that the defendant and his co-conspirators had discussions about the product. And there was also, it was stipulated, and that's in footnote 5, that the defendant and his co-conspirator were engaged in a joint and common interest. Yet that still was not enough because the factual basis for the liability was not the communication, it was the conduct. It was the conduct in peddling that phony medical product. And the reason the court came to that conclusion is because the scope of the TCPA has to have some limits. This court recognized that in Crestview, and in the October 2018 decision, which we cite in our brief, the In Re Intellicentrics case, this court came out and flat out said the scope of the TCPA must have limits. Under the appellant's argument, there is literally, it's an unbounded interpretation of the TCPA where the statute would apply in every single case where a defendant acted with another.
Let me stop you right there. Doesn't the legislature tell us in the TCPA that we have to interpret broadly? You'll agree with that, won't you?
Well, Your Honor, Justice Pittman, you interpret it within the scope of the definition of communication.
But you'll agree we've been admonished and instructed by the legislature to interpret the statute broadly, wouldn't you?
Correct. The case is saying that I think the Texas Supreme Court has said that the statute's broad, but it's not unbounded. And this court in Crestview and in Intellicentrics said that the scope can't be limitless. And under the defendant...
Yeah, are you familiar with Justice Pemberton's concurrence in the Serafine case?
The Serafine case, no, I'm familiar with a couple of his decisions out of the Austin court.
As judges, it's not really for us to judge whether something's good public policy or bad public policy. We are stuck with the language that the legislature gives us. And one of the things Justice Pemberton pointed out was that if we are to apply the TCPA as written, it could literally apply to any communication made between a married couple when they wake up in the morning. It's very broad, and we're instructed to interpret it broadly. How do you respond to those types of arguments? So we have this instruction here but the plain language is broad. We have an admonition to interpret it broadly.
Sure, and I think what you're getting at is where are the parameters on the statute?
Correct.
And I think Justice Basil asked that question earlier. And here's the best way, I think, to crystallize it, is the communication has to form the factual basis for the liability. So, for example, in a defamation case, it is the statement, the defamatory statement itself, that is the communication that forms the basis for liability. In some of the cases that Justice Pemberton wrote about, they involved, and it's a good example, it's the Grant case. So the Grant case was a contract case involving an anti-solicitation, a case involving, you know, not soliciting business. So the contract was breached in that case based on the solicitation itself, that is the communication. So in those cases, Justice Pittman, there's limits to the statute where the factual basis of liability is based on the communication. That distinguishes those cases that Justice Pemberton wrote about in Grant versus Crestview and Intellicentrics, and this case where the statute, where the cause of action and the liability, the defendant's liability, is based on conduct.
Do you think you can reconcile Crestview with Grant, Autocraft, and Elite out of Austin, or are they at loggerheads with each other?
They're not at loggerheads, Your Honor, and it's for that reason you look at what the factual basis for liability is. So in Crestview, this case, and in Intellicentrics, it's the conduct that forms the factual basis for liability. So Antero, in this case, it's not suing Mr. Kowchek over any communications that he engaged in. It's suing him over the quid pro quo of taking bribes and kickbacks and hiring his co-conspirators companies. In Grant involved in a non-solicitation. So it was the solicitation of the employees and the solicitation of the business that formed the basis of liability. So they're perfectly, one can reconcile them, there's no inconsistency in them. The inconsistency comes in the way that the appellant tries to stretch Grant and stretch Elite Auto Body beyond really what the holding in those cases are. And just to be clear, under the defendant's interpretation, the TCPA would apply and be triggered in any case involving more than one person. So any civil conspiracy case, any aiding and abetting case, any case under the Texas antitrust laws, by definition, because it requires some type of interaction with another person, that would trigger the statute. And Antero raised that in his brief. His response is, well, that's okay because the plaintiff can still avoid liability if it establishes a prima facie case. But that's not the test under the statute, and it's also not the test under the cases, especially within the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. The case is counseled that there has to be some type of teeth to that first step. It just doesn't blindly apply. And it just stretches the scope of the statute, you know, to an unlimited, a limitless, you know, possibility.
Do you have an opinion what the word common means and the definition of the right of association?
Well, Justice Basso, I think what's instructive on that is to look at the Crestview case, where in Crestview, in footnote 5, it was conceded or not disputed that the defendant and his co-conspirator were engaged in a joint or common interest. So, but that wasn't sufficient to trigger the applicability of the TCPA.
Okay, but that doesn't answer my question. What, do you agree with them about the breadth of the use of the word common in the definition of the right to associate, or right of association?
Well, I would defer to Webster's and the dictionary definition and the plain meaning of it, but it's still cabined by the TCPA's and Section 27's requirement for there to be a communication. That requirement is unequivocal, no exceptions. The liability has to be based on the communication. So at the first step, we submit that Antero's, the basis for Mr. Kowchek's liability, it's the quid pro quo. That's conduct under Crestview, and therefore the TCPA doesn't apply at the first step. But going further, so even if the TCPA applies, there's still a basis to affirm the trial court's decision in full because Antero established a prima facie case for its claims. And I don't think there's much dispute on that point now. And I direct the court to page 15 of the appellant's brief where he concedes that taking bribes and kickbacks would constitute a breach of a fiduciary duty. And in the record, there's tons of evidence that that's what's happened. We have $729,000 in cash payments. We have a free plane. All the expenses on the plane were paid. And there's really a lack of any bona fide justification.
Do you still have a prima facie case if we don't consider the evidence that was filed after the hearing?
The post here, absolutely, Your Honor. And to go with the post-hearing evidence, one, it's proper, I think, under Bandon that the trial court invited the evidence. And the reason Antero submitted that post-hearing evidence was to rebut just blatant misstatements that were filed in support of the defendant appellant's reply brief. For example, the defendant said that, tried to rebut the notion that his co-conspirator wasn't the sole provider of services. The first time he made that statement was in his reply brief. So that could have been in his opening TCPA motion. He waited to submit that until the night before the hearing. And so naturally, Antero responded to that and pointed out that that was just a false statement. And there's nothing wrong with the trial court asking for the submission of that evidence to point out the inconsistencies in the characterization of the record. But just to go back to page 15, he concedes that taking bribes and kickbacks would constitute, a breach of fiduciary duty. And I just want to talk about his invocation of the equal inference rule. What he is asking the court to do at this point is to weigh the evidence. He's asking the court to decide conclusively at the TCPA stage what's more plausible, that these millions of dollars in cash payments and benefits are more indicative of a bribery and kickback scheme, or is it, or is there an innocent explanation to that? And I think, if I may quote this court's decision from 2017 in the Dallas Morning News case, I think it's instructive on that point, that this court is not to act as a fact finder. This court wrote, quote, "There can be no doubt that the trial court's role is not to act as a fact finder and to resolve opposing reasonable inferences, but instead to determine whether the non-movement met its burden to produce evidence sufficient to meet its burden under the TCPA. It goes on to say, the evidence may include relevant evidence which more than one reasonable inference may be drawn." The court's not supposed to act as a fact finder. With respect to the equal inference rule in particular, the Lozano case that we cite that in footnote 11 of our brief, the appellant just completely mischaracterizes the rule. The equal inference rule is a species, this is according to the Texas Supreme Court, of a no evidence summary judgment rule. And the Supreme Court explicitly wrote that if there's more than one reasonable inference, it is for a jury to decide. And Mr. Kowchek is fine to make his argument that there's innocent explanations for the evidence, but that's a jury, that's for a jury to decide. A trial court shouldn't decide that on directed verdict. It shouldn't decide that at summary judgment, and it certainly shouldn't decide that at the early stage of the proceedings of the TCPA, where the only question is whether the plaintiff has submitted the minimum quantum of evidence to support a rational inference that the allegations are true. Antero submits that millions of dollars in money that came in from Mr. Kowchek's alleged co-conspirator is more than sufficient to raise to clear that initial threshold.
Has there ever been a case that applied the equal inference rule in this prima facie determination under the TCPA?
No, there hasn't, Your Honor. And I'd also direct the court to the authority that says when evaluating whether a plaintiff has established a prima facie case, it's the Moldovan, the D Magazine case, which Antero cites in pages 26 to 27. Those cases hold that prima facie evidence is not subject to rebuttal, and the court only considers the evidence in the light most favored to the plaintiff. Now, there's a very small, I think, exception that's been recognized when the defendant can submit some type of proof that conclusively proves, but I haven't seen a case that has ever said that the defendant's evidence conclusively, rebuts or the plaintiff's evidence. And the couple cases that I have seen, it says that affidavits denying allegations at most just raise a fact issue. And they don't conclusively presume, the lack of plausibility in our case. Antero's met that low threshold to establish a prima facie case. So we'll submit that the TCPA does not apply at the threshold. And even if it did, Antero's more than established a prima facie case for its claims. And therefore, there's multiple independent reasons to affirm the trial court's ruling.
But if we buy their argument about how related the communication has to be, then they've gotten over the initial hump, in your view, with respect to proving a right of association?
Well, their argument is that there is a communication. I mean, they have to argue that to trigger the statute in the first place. So that's how the analysis goes. Step one is, does the TCPA apply? If it does, is there a prima facie case?
I agree with that.
Right.
But I'm just saying, if we buy their related to communication argument, do they get over the first step?
I think the answer is yes to that. And that's just, I think, the court presuming that step one is made. Again, our position is that they don't satisfy that because this is a conduct case, because liability is based on the conduct, not any communication. And I'll just note one more case, in close was Justice Pittman's case in the Bevin versus Beatles case, I believe, where the court starts from the conclusion that the plaintiff's allegations are not based on protected content or any protected conduct. And in the record, both at the trial court and on appeal, the appellant has not pointed to any communication that forms a factual basis for liability. So on those basis, the appellee would request that this court affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The Mr. Thompson just in his very first opening paragraph, opening statement, said that the communication has to form the basis of the liability. That's what we're alleging. The communication is the scheme. He said quid pro quo multiple times. And he said Mr. Kowchek in the ongoing bribery kickback scheme, presupposing that this supposed bribery and kickback scheme materialized out of thin air.
So how do you distinguish this from Crestview? Because in Crestview, what was going on there, too, had to come from communication. You're saying the scheme to take kickbacks and so forth had to come from communication. So what are the distinguishing factors in these two cases?
I believe the distinguishing factors are the pleadings themselves, Your Honor. In Crestview, the pleadings were specifically and limited to the conduct. This court said, with respect to Crestview did not include allegations against Smith that included disclosure of information by statement or document. They did. They said disclosure of information. That's one distinguishing characteristic of this case. And it said that Crestview specifically and narrowly alleged that Smith's actions aided Anderson in her violations of the TSA. And those specific actions, that as pled, according to the case, were rendered substantial assistance in furtherance of Armstrong's conduct, conducted clandestine testing, failed to keep medical records, and violated Texas Medical Board regulations in connections with his assistance of Armstrong's sale. Those were the allegations that were pled. Here, a scheme has been pled, a scheme that supports the allegation. But well, I know my time is short, Your Honor. I'd like to address the argument that Mr. Thompson made about waiving the right to bring a TCPA claim based on the serving of discovery. I think that flies in the face of the statute, which specifically and literally says all discovery is suspended when a TCPA motion is filed. That presupposes that discovery was ongoing before discovery was suspended. So I don't believe that that's a basis for throwing out a TCPA claim because discovery had been asked, which brings in the fact that they asked, we asked them for every document that they provided as both pre-hearing and post-hearing had already been requested in discovery and not produced in response to that discovery. So we asked for it in discovery, didn't get it. Why did you sue Mr. Kowchek? Give us the basis of the lawsuit. They didn't do it. They said, oh, we'll meet and confer, et cetera, et cetera. Then we filed a motion to dismiss. We gave them an extra 15 days before the hearing. 75 days, we get to the hearing, they're still asking the court for additional submissions. And Antero continues to rely on IntelliCentrics. One of the things that IntelliCentrics does stand for is at that hearing, the movement must first show that it's entitled to bring the motion to dismiss. And then, if successful, the burden shifts from the movement to the respondent to establish by clear and specific evidence. At the hearing, not after the hearing, no one asked for additional discovery pursuant to 27.006. The record was the record as of the hearing date.
You supplied supplemental evidence as well, did you not?
In response to theirs, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
you, the last reply brief you filed was the night before the hearing. So because you got gotcha, because you got last word, they don't get a chance to respond when the trial court asked for the response?
No, Your Honor, I would submit that the trial court agreed to their request. I mean, we filed our motion to dismiss.
Okay,
they
agreed for the request, asked for it. Certainly the trial court was looking for an opportunity for them to respond to what you filed at the last moment, correct?
I don't believe that is, as Mr. Swindle said in the hearing, the court asked us if we wanted additional submissions, and we said, Mr. Kowchek, we're here on the evidence that's here today. We're not asking for additional submissions. And the court, specifically in the order denying the motion to dismiss, said that the court considered the supplemental submissions, and we believe that that was improper. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
The state of the record, let's assume that the trial court erred in taking evidence after the hearing. What was the state of the record with respect to the evidence before the hearing? He says there's enough in there. What's your position?
We disagree, Your Honor. We disagree. And there were multiple submissions that we believe would, without those submissions, that they would not have, assuming that Judge Lowe felt that we had met the bar on the communication prong, that there was not sufficient evidence to prove they're clear and specific on every element of the claim.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your briefing and your arguments here this afternoon. They've been very helpful. Your case is submitted.